Well, I don't want to spend a hell of a lot of time talking today because the activity takes quite a bit of time, actually. So I want to give you as much time as possible to finish it. We're doing some testing today for presence of various macromolecules, often in science in general, but biology, we're dealing with a solution that we don't really know the contents of, and it would be nice to know the contents. So various tests have been devised to check whether or not certain categories of chemicals are in that solution. And we're just going to work with three of many such tests today, which you should already know the names of and what they test for. We're going to be doing the Biuret test, which tests for what? Right? IKI test, which tests for what? Starch. And the Benedict's test, which tests for? For what? Everyone hear that?
Glucose and fructose.
For example, but not only those. Right, monosaccharides in general, of which there's no limit to the number of. There's several that are important in food, but in chemistry there's all kinds of monosaccharide. Two of these three tests are pretty straightforward as far as conducting them and completing the exercise, which are the Biuret's test and the IKI test. So I'm not going to say anything more about those, except to tell you that IKI is an acronym for iodine, potassium iodide. So there's iodine atoms in there twice, actually. Iodine, potassium iodide. And that's real obvious when you use it, so it'll be straightforward when you do it. The one I want to talk just a little bit more about, though, is the Benedict's test, which tests for monosaccharides. Especially because the background for how it works is something we're going to be talking a hell of a lot more about in Unit 3 once we get past the second test. And that has to do with redox, which is a portmanteau, meaning a word that combines two other words. Redox is just short for reduction, oxidation. So there are all kinds of redox reactions that are important for various reasons. But the reason that we use it as one word, reduction, oxidation, and one word, redox, is that if there is going to be a reduction or an oxidation, if one happens, then they both happen. They don't happen in isolation. They either both happen or neither happens. This involves a transfer of electrons. That's why you can't have one without the other. If there's a transfer, something is losing electrons, something's receiving electron. Now, the words might seem backwards, because we're used to thinking of the word reduction meaning the loss of something, right? Like a reduction in weight, weight-reducing diet, you lose weight. But in redox, reduction is the gain of electrons, whereas oxidation is the loss of electrons. All right, now, that still makes sense, though, when you consider charge, because an electron is negatively charged, right? So if you get reduced, which means you receive an electron, your charge is going down numerically, right? So think of it that way. But however you think about it, reduction is the gain of electrons, oxidation is the loss. And that's why you can't have one without the other. The electron doesn't cease to exist or just pop into existence. It comes from somewhere, it goes to somewhere, and therefore, whenever there's a reduction, there's a corresponding oxidation. Now, to add to the confusion in the wording, in a redox reaction, the thing that is becoming reduced, which is the thing that is receiving the electron, right, is called the oxidizing agent. And that's because by being reduced, by receiving the electron, it is oxidizing something else, right? So it's the oxidizing agent. And correspondingly, the thing that's being oxidized by losing the electron is called the reducing agent, because it's causing something else to be reduced by receiving that electron from it. I mean, by sending that electron to it, sorry. Okay? Well, monosaccharides are considered to be, or are called, reducing sugars because they serve as reducing agents. Meaning they can become oxidized, losing an electron, and thereby reducing something that will receive that electron. Does all that make sense based on those definitions? Okay, so now notice we have two tests that are testing for sugars. Starch is a polysaccharide. It's a complex sugar or a complex carbohydrate that's made by hooking together a bunch of monosaccharides. In the case of starch, which is just one of several polysaccharides, it's nothing but glucose, really. It's a bunch of glucoses stuck together. But if you subject starch or a starch-containing solution to the Benedict's test, it's going to be a negative test. Even though there's nothing but glucose in there, it's not glucoses that are individual glucose molecules. They're not in monosaccharide form, right? So the test will fail. But if you subject starch to an IKI test, it will be positive because it tests specifically for starch. Now, there's an important reason why disaccharides or polysaccharides, in other words, complex sugars, will not work in the Benedict's test. And this has to do with what you learned last week in here when you were building your models. Remember, you built glucose, which is just one of many different monosaccharides, and you built two versions of it, right? A linear version, and then you turned it into a ringed version. They were both glucose, but notice that, or remember that in the ringed version, there was no carbonyl group, right? Because you had to eliminate a bond from the double bond in order to make the final bond to make the ring, right? Well, if you were to build either a disaccharide or higher level, a polysaccharide, in other words, if you're hooking monosaccharides together to build a bigger molecule, those monosaccharides that you're using as building blocks have to be in the ringed form. They can't be in the linear form. Okay? And once you bond them together covalently to make that bigger molecule, they no longer go back and forth between ringed and linear. Hooking them together locks each of the monosaccharides that are constituents of the bigger molecule into the ringed form. But if a monosaccharide is by itself, not hooked to another one, it can easily go back and forth between ringed and linear forms. And the reason that's important for Benedict's test is explained on page 76. And this has to do with this is where the redox comes into play. Benedict's solution is the blue stuff you're going to be working with today. It's, that is to say, it's blue before you use it, before you use put something in it. And really what it is a solution of copper ions. But if you look at the periodic table and find copper, which is Cu, it's right here, this block of metals is known as the transition metals. Now, these first two groups are not transition metals. They're still metals, of course, but everyone in the group one, if they're going to form ions, they always form an ion by losing exactly one electron. There's only one way to make an ion. Same for two, only they lose group two, except they lose two electrons instead, right? As, according to what we've learned in lecture. But the some of the metals in the transition metals can form ions any of multiple different ways, and that includes copper. All right, so that's why there are two versions of copper ions. Copper 2, which we write as Cu with a 2 plus superscript, and copper 1 with a 1 plus superscript. It shouldn't surprise you that these are positive ions because it's a metal, right? Metals lose electrons to form ions, so that makes them positive. So, in solution, in just pure Benedict's reagent, before you use it as a test, there's trillions and trillions of copper 2 ions. So they have lost two electrons from the atomic state, right? From the neutral copper, non-ionized copper. They've lost two electrons to become positive 2. If you put back an electron, one of the two that were lost, that's going to transform it into a copper 1 ion, right? It lost 2 to become a 2 plus. You give it back 1, it's going to be a 1 plus. Well, copper 1 ions in solution give the solution a brick red color, not blue. And that's the basis of the test. It can test for something that will give an electron to the copper 2 ions in solution, transforming them into copper 1 ions. So if that happens, what is happening to copper, chemically speaking? In terms of redox, what's happening to the copper 2 ion? No. Right, and we're gaining an electron when we go from positive 2 to positive 1. Right, it's a reduction numerically in the charge. From 2 to 1 is going down in charge by receiving a negative electron, right? So what's happening, if that does happen, is that copper 2 ions are being reduced. They're receiving an electron. Is that all clear? Well, the source of the electron is the double bond, and this is what's shown on page 76, the double bond of the carbonyl group that any monosaccharide has. It's not just glucose that you built. Any monosaccharide will have a carbonyl somewhere in it. And remember that a carbonyl has a double bond. That double bond really is 4 electrons, so it's a rich source of electrons, one of which can be removed and sent to copper 2 instead, transforming it into copper 1. And that turns the solution from blue to red. Okay? But notice that if the sugar is in the ringed form, it's not going to happen. And it would be locked in that ring form if it's part of a bigger a polysaccharide. But if it's just a bunch of monosaccharides, they're flipping back and forth between linear and ringed, and therefore, as soon as they get into the linear form, they can give an electron to a copper ion and turn it to copper 1. So that's how it works. Now, any one of these tests, not just Benedict's, but all three of these that you're doing today, just give you qualitative results, not quantitative. Meaning you can tell whether or not something is present. It doesn't tell you how much by, you know, it doesn't give you a quantity. Except kind of. It won't give you a number, but Benedict's test especially kind of gives you a feel for how much is there, if there is any. Because it doesn't just blink straight from blue to brick red. It goes through the other colors, which is why you have that little spectrum picture on the next page. And so you can not only tell whether or not there are monosaccharides present, but by how far it gets toward the red extreme, kind of how many there are. You know, not a number, but you could compare two solutions, for instance, and say this one has more than this because it changed more toward red. Okay, all that clear? That's the background. I just want to tell you a couple things about running the experiments. One is that you're using acid today and other chemicals, so as soon as I shut up, you need to put goggles on and keep them on the whole time, and gloves. Especially because you're using two acids, but one of the versions is really dangerous stuff. It'll hurt you. That's the stuff in here that you use only for the coagulation part. You'll get to that part in the procedure. But this acid has to stay in here. You have weaker acid at your counter that you can work with there. But when it comes time to getting the strong acid, it has to stay in here. You have to come over here to get it. All right. Another thing about this coagulation experiment, which you don't start with, but you'll get to it, is that it's going to leave tubes full of albumin that looks cooked, egg white that looks cooked. And there's no way you're going to be able to shake it out of the tube. Just put waste from this experiment only into the HCl waste that's full of tubes right now, but I'll deal with that. And then the tube itself, put over into this white bin. Okay, just leave the egg white in there. Don't try to get it out. Another thing is that you might not have used these repipe headers before, which is a pump, but it's not like a shampoo pump. So don't come over here and push down on this. Be gentle with it, first of all. But also, you don't push down, you pull up. So it's kind of opposite. First, just make sure your tube is under the spout. Gently pull this. Don't mess with the setting. It's set. Just gently pull up this whole white part until it stops. And then gently push it down until it stops, and that'll give you the right amount into your tube.
Can you repeat that one more time?
Yes. Which, from the start, from right after the quiz? Or just this part?
Just this part.
It's simpler than I'm making it sound, but just make sure you're under the spout so you collect it all. And instead of pushing down, you pull this whole thing up until it stops. You'll feel it stop, and then just, if it doesn't fall down on its own, just gently push it down until it stops again. That'll deliver the right amount. Now, the main reason you have some preliminary work to do before you get to the reason you're doing all of this is because to use these tests well, you need to know what a positive result looks like and a negative result. And so you do that preliminary work using knowns, things that you know what they are, and those are labeled in your white baskets. You have various knowns to work with. So for each of the three tests, one by one, you want to test something that you know should give you a positive result because it is what the test is testing for. Right, so definitely choose a protein for the Bayouret test. Definitely choose a monosaccharide for Benedict's, and so on. Those, and then look at those results. That's what a positive looks like, you know. But also for each test, test something that you know should be a negative, like pure water, for instance, or something else that you know does not definitely have the thing you're testing for, and get a good idea what the negative and positive look like. Once you've done all of that, then you can proceed to trying to identify the unknowns, which are over here. Now, each group is going to pick, doesn't matter what number, because there's four of each, but each group is going to take back some A, some B, and some C. Okay, but make sure you write down which A it is, which B it is, and which C it is, because all four are different for each letter. All right, those are unknowns. You don't know what's in there, except you know that it's something from the table on page... keep going. Yeah, what pick?
83.
On 83, those are you know it's something from that table 83. And the idea here is to try to pin it down what is in each of your three unknowns. And you do that by subjecting each of your unknowns, an A, a B, and a C, to all three of the tests. Okay, so you test your A for using Benedict's, using IKI, and separately, of course, in separate tubes, and Biuret as well. Does that all make sense? So once you get your results for the unknown, then you try to narrow it down using the table, and then you come check with me. Tell me what your unknowns were and what your guesses are, and I'll tell you whether you're right. Oh, you're also supposed to do the pH testing, but that takes only a couple minutes. But that's why you have these trays out. Okay, that's it.